thank you so much, Dan, for that really lovely introduction and for reminding me that I lived in my car, which I kind of forgot about. And thank you all so much for coming out this evening and for inviting me here. It's my first trip to Miami, and I've really, really enjoyed my time here, even though everyone keeps telling me it's cold. But I live in New York, so I, you know, spent the day looking at the beach going, wow, it's beautiful. As Dan spoke a little bit about this, I wrote this book for my big brother, Roy. And Roy was my only sibling, and we grew up in upstate New York in Rochester in a little white two-story colonial with our mom and dad, and had a very unextraordinary and blessedly happy childhood. And Roy had, you know I'm biased, but he had a lot of wonderful qualities. I think his finest quality was that he was extraordinarily fond of me. In fact, we were so constantly together that my mom came up with a nickname for us, and she combined our first names into a shorthand name, and she called us both Alroy. And in the summer of 1984, Roy, or Alroy, was 18, and he had just graduated from the boys' Catholic school in town, and I was 15 that summer, and he had two jobs because he was saving money to go to college, and he worked at the supermarket called Tops Friendly Market, and he had to wear an extremely dorky red vest apron that he hated, and he had a second job he loved. He was the groundskeeper at this local golf course, so all day long he would dig ditches and fix the greens and just work in the mud and the dirt, and he absolutely loved this. And he came home like covered in mud. You could barely recognize him, and I was convinced that, you know, if he wasn't fully mud covered by the end of the day, he would just like roll in the dirt, just so that my mother would be sufficiently driven crazy. And then one morning in late August, there was a big rainstorm, and my brother left for work that morning, and he never came back. He died in a car accident a half mile from the house. And when something like this happens to you, your life is just reduced to two things. There was before Roy died, and after Roy died, and there was nothing else. But, you know, we all had to go on, and so I went on by attending Our Lady of Mercy School for Girls, where I got myself into a lot of trouble, which I wrote about in the book, but I managed to graduate. And then I, you know, went to college, where I got myself into a whole other kind of trouble, which I didn't write about in the book. And I managed to graduate it again, and I started working sort of nonprofit education jobs. I thought I'd be a teacher. And I was kind of bad at everything I did. I wasn't totally there. I couldn't be present doing this important work I was doing. I kept looking behind me. I kept looking over my shoulder, trying to figure out where Roy was. And I didn't like the fact that everywhere I went, nobody had ever met him. I'd never be able to introduce him to anybody ever again. And so I came up with this totally nutty idea, and I decided I was going to write a book about him. And I would write a book and sort of bring him back into the world. Can you imagine having that much hubris? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was young. And as Dan read in that interview, I had no idea how hard it was going to be. But I think sometimes we do this to ourselves. You know, we choose something that we might not initially be really good at. We might initially be completely blind to what we need to know in order to do it. And I think that's why some part of us chooses to do it. And so, like, here's one mistake I made in writing Name All the Animals. My first draft was 800 pages long. Okay, that's not even the mistake, actually. The mistake was that I wasn't even a character in those 800 pages. So That's a pretty extraordinary problem for a memoirist, to not include herself as a character in the book. Like, I bet none of you would have made that mistake. But I discovered it was the reason I had to write the book in a certain way, because what I learned was, as much as I wanted to honor Roy and I wanted Roy to be the main character, I could not write from any other point of view but my own. And I had nothing but my point of view. And I think that's true for all memoirists. It doesn't matter what horrible or fantastic thing happened to you or how many celebrities were involved. You don't have anything but your point of view. And it took a number of drafts before I started to understand that, as much as I thought the sister's perspective is not the point of view that anyone is interested in, and that had sort of been reinforced by our culture, because this is a fact that I learned recently. There are more articles written every year about how to cope with the loss of a pet than how to cope with the loss of a brother or a sister. So it just really hadn't occurred to me that it was a legitimate point of view to write from, which is the little sister's point of view. And the first thing I want to read to you tonight is the first thing I wrote, finally, this is probably like 3 years into the process, that in which I started to write a little bit from the point of view of a 15-year-old girl. And it's part of chapter 3. And just to set it up, it was 3 weeks after Roy died, and my mom was recreating from scratch the camper van that my brother died in, which is a pretty extraordinary thing to do, but it's another part of the story. And one afternoon while she was working on the van in the backyard, this guy showed up. 3 weeks later, a young man walked down our driveway, ducked around the lilac bush, stepped into the backyard, and stuck his hand out. "Hello, Mrs. Smith," he said. "Remember me?" Mother wiped the wood stain off her fingers and set down her paintbrush, and she shook his hand. "I'm Paul," he said. "I sold your son the encyclopedias. I just came by with a purchase order." Paul looked across the yard. The garage door was open, and just inside stood a workbench fashioned from two wooden sawhorses and a length of plywood. "Where's Roy?" Paul grinned. He slapped his hands together. "Is he all packed for school?" My mother sunk down onto the picnic bench and stared at her wet paintbrush. "Mrs. Smith," Paul ventured, "are you okay?" She turned the paintbrush over in her palm and stared deep into its bristles. Paul looked over toward me where I stood in the garden, a trowel held loosely in my hand. He raised his eyebrows as if to ask for help. He was just about to speak when Father pushed back the screen door and walked into the yard. He headed straight for Mother and put his hand on her shoulder. "We forgot about the encyclopedias," Mother said. Paul started to back out of the yard. "You know, if this is a bad time, I could always..." My father interrupted. "No," he said, and he looked at Paul. He let his gaze rest for a beat too long on Paul's shoulders. Paul was larger than Roy, more the football player type, but he had the same skin that was warm and freckled and tan. Paul crossed his arms over his white t-shirt. He tried to smile, and the corners of his mouth quivered, bringing out the dimples on his cheeks. Father offered Paul a seat at the picnic table. "Roy died, Paul," Father said. In June, Paul had come to the door selling mail-order encyclopedias for college students. Roy showed some interest, and Mother and Father bought him a set on installment. They were to arrive two each month at his Purdue dorm for the first year of college. By the end of his freshman year, he would have a complete set. As Paul searched for something to say, Mother got up, walked back to the garage, put on a pair of safety goggles, and fired up her circular saw. Paul rubbed the back of his neck and stared at the purchase order now crumpled in his hand. "The thing is, sir," he said, "there's a no-refund policy on these encyclopedias." When Paul left, I followed him. I caught up with him near the Henderson's driveway and tagged along until he turned around and looked at me. He made a small gesture with his hand, inviting me to join him. Paul held a clipboard and a blue zipper bag for the checks. As he walked, he bounced them against his thigh. "What's your mother building?" Paul asked. "A camper van," I said. Paul stopped then in the middle of the street. He looked down at me as if he were really taking me in for the first time. He was perfectly still for a moment. Then he flicked his thumb against the zipper of his money bag and asked, "How can you build a camper van?" "I don't know," I said, "but she's doing it." Paul's hair was parted in the middle, forming two tapering feathers that cascaded down his forehead. The soft breeze caught them and lifted them away from his face. They trembled in the wind and then settled back down into an upside-down V right above his eyebrows. Paul started walking. I followed along again. It was late in the day, and the sun was just sliding down below the roofs of the tiny houses on our street. As we passed from house to house, sunlight fell on us for a moment and then disappeared behind the shingled facades. In that occasional, intermittent light, I gazed up at Paul. The sun caught him from behind, and the white outline of his t-shirt glowed. I liked Paul. I liked him for the simple fact that he didn't know Roy was gone. He was part of a near-extinct breed, those people who had somehow missed the newspaper article, the television coverage, the local radio reports, and the endless web of phone calls. He was one of the before people. The before people had me in their thrall. And here I was, walking alongside one of them, Paul, the encyclopedia boy. Just a few minutes ago, he knew nothing about Roy's death. Just a few minutes ago, Roy was still alive inside Paul's head. I imagined him there, in Paul's mind, right under that perfect hair. Roy, packing for college. Roy, reading encyclopedias. In that innocence, that powerful ignorance, Roy lived. I remember that was a section of the book that I showed to a friend of mine who was helping me with writing it, and I said, "I think the part in the yard with my parents is okay, but I'm going to cut that whole stupid before people thing, okay?" And she said, "Actually, that's really the only good thing you have so far." I was like, "But it's so dorky. I mean, my God, before people." And she said, "Yeah, but that's your character. That's who this girl is." And it's when it dawned on me, that idea that this is what you have. You know, as much as you wish when you're writing a memoir that you were someone else, or you thought different things, or you were smarter, you were further ahead, you weren't. You can't pretend that. And what I have discovered in publishing the book is that so many people have said to me, "Oh yeah, the before people. I thought the same thing." And so that was the first challenge, was sort of getting into this 15-year-old girl's mind and how she thought about her brother and grief and her not so realistic notions about what death meant. And the second challenge for me was that the book was not just a portrait of grief, but it was also a coming-of-age story. It was and a coming-out story. Because 2 years after Roy died, I fell in love with a girl in the all-girls Catholic convent school I attended, and we had a secret affair, and then we got caught, and then there was a big scandal. But before that could all happen, I had to wake up a little bit. And I was so busy grieving that I hadn't really had time to think about anything, including my sexuality or anybody else's. And then my history teacher came along, and she assigned us all in her class on American history to lead a debate. And she handed out these topics randomly. And Miss Beale, in 1984 in upstate New York, in an all-girls Catholic school, chose as one of the debate topics gay and lesbian rights, which she swears I was put on that team randomly. but, you know, I don't even know, and this is shocking, but I don't even know if I had ever really heard the word lesbian. And I was a deeply self-involved, mildly depressed person at that point. And I didn't want to do this assignment. And I hadn't really thought about anyone else's struggle. But I, you know, I followed the rules and I went to the library and I started my research for this, what I consider to be rather onerous and irrelevant homework assignment. I found a few resources in the card catalog, but I wrote down the names of a handful of books with the keywords gay or homosexual in the titles. I copied out their call numbers. And then I went to the shelves, and not a single one of the books was on the shelf. I tracked down the reference librarian and handed him my list. "I can't find any of these," I said. He looked at the crumpled piece of paper with the six titles and the corresponding call numbers. And then he glanced up at me, at my braids, and then fixed his watery brown eyes on the Catholic school uniform. "We keep these books in the basement stacks," he said, and he turned away. "Can I see them?" He stopped and turned back around and gave me another long look. Then he took a handkerchief out of his pocket and wiped the corners of his mouth and folded it twice and slipped it back into his pocket, nodded slowly. "Wait here," he said. I waited. 5 minutes passed, and then 10. I set down my book. I pulled off my winter hat. And finally I sat down on a chair across from the reference station and stared at the metal door in the back wall where a half hour earlier the librarian had disappeared. Just when I was about to give up on him, the metal door creaked open and he reappeared, brushed the dust off his sleeve, and set 5 books on the counter. "This is all I could find," he said, and he slid the stack of books across the counter to me. I thanked him and I found a place in the history section. I plodded through the books, taking notes, rereading Miss Beale's ditto titled 5 Steps to a Good Debate, and trying to figure out what we should choose as our platform, how we could win this thing. I stared out the window and down at the cars passing below. I took a few more notes. I doodled in my journal. I flipped through a few more books. I was just about to gather my notes and call it a day when I came across a set of lithographs called The Reading Lesson. They were from the second half of the 19th century. The artist who made them was not mentioned. In the first print, 2 women in Victorian clothing are seated next to each other in a schoolroom. The one on the left holds the book, and the one on the right leans over, her hand on the other's arm, and points to the book. I had seen plenty of prints like these. In fact, I love this sort of thing. 2 girls sewing, or afternoon tea. It reminded me of the characters in Pride and Prejudice, of Elizabeth Bennet and her gaggle of lively sisters. I like to imagine myself in these prints, sitting next to the girls, sewing with them or reading aloud together. Oh my God, I cannot believe what a nerd I was. There was nothing unusual about this image. I wondered what this picture was doing in a book about the history of homosexuals. Then I turned the page, and I looked at the second print, and I almost dropped my notebook. In this one, the book lies open on the floor at the women's feet, discarded, flung aside, its pages rippling. The woman on the left now sits on the other one's lap. And there, in sepia print tones, in Victorian dresses with crinolines and bodices and hairnets and little white gloves, the blackboard bannered out behind them, the lesson long forgotten, the lady's kiss. And this was no schoolgirl peck on the cheek kiss. Their bodices pressed against each other, arms clasped around each other, clutching at the folds of their dresses. They were holding on for dear life. The one seated on the bench, her face turned up, her hands on the other's back, pressing her closer. The one on her lap, bending down, her fingers in the other one's hair, mussing her perfect bun. I stared at that print. I blinked. I stared some more. At the bottom, there was a caption. Circa 1857, it read. I did a few mental calculations. They had been kissing like that, passionately, shamelessly, for 129 years. Thank you very much.